ready, Patrick?
Yes, sir.
Welcome, everybody. This is the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. For the record, it's March 1st, 2017, so we've been here a month now. All righty, we're going to start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 344, so we'll open that. And Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 344 requires snowmobiles and certain ATVs to cross a highway at an intersection or more than 100 feet from an intersection. It allows a road authority to authorize persons in remote areas to operate ATVs within a portion of the highway right-of-way that is designated as an ATV access route. It provides an exemption for vehicle equipment requirements of the vehicle operators crossing a portion of a highway right-of-way as a designated access route. And it also establishes an ATV access routes advisory committee and directs the OTC to designate ATV access routes throughout Oregon in consultation with that advisory committee. This measure does have substantial referral, Mr. Chair, to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. Senator Farioli, welcome to the Business and Transportation Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Thank you for considering Senate Bill 344. As Mr. Brennan just explained, the bill allows a road authority to authorize the use of ATVs within the highway right-of-way. Currently, we have such a right vested in farmers and ranchers so long as they've posted a slow-moving vehicle sticker on lands that they own adjacent to highways. So they can cross the roads, they can move irrigation pipe, they can use ATVs to move from field to field, to move cattle, do all the stuff that would be facilitated by a three-wheeler or a four-wheeler. This bill is different. This bill allows jurisdictions that have less than 20,000 in a county of less than 20,000 in population to actually allow ATVs to be used for by citizens who may simply want to use them in lieu of larger vehicles to cross town, go to the store, make a quick trip to the to do their necessaries, shopping and so forth, or to use them recreationally. So long as they do not use them on state highways, what would be required would be a county authority and a road authority designating that portion of the roadway to be an all-terrain vehicle access route. And it would also require that road authority to post signs warning motorists that they might encounter this kind of traffic. The typical four-wheel ATV today has seat belts, roll cage, turn signals, headlights. I mean, they are not a roadworthy vehicle in the sense that they are an automobile, but they are not far from that situation. In areas that have less population, more remote areas, this is a viable option for transportation for people. It's less energy intensive, certainly. There are safety considerations, and that's why we want this advisory committee composed of Oregon Transportation Commission members, Oregon State Police, Oregon ODOT director or designee, representatives of city, traffic engineer, ATV dealer, members of various ATV user communities would collaborate on designations of these routes. It does require the group to come together to designate these access routes. And those folks would be considered need to connect, minimizing effects on adjacent lands, road conditions, the level of desire in the community, and consistency for purposes of planning. So, colleagues, this is a recognition that ATVs have come a long way. They are not ready for prime time in that you will not see them on state highways or federal highways, but they would be able to cross within 100 feet of an intersection or diagonally, depending on the physical layout of those crossings. They would not necessarily be able to use state highways or federally designated highways for transport or general use. Crossing, yes. Using the highway, not. It's all in the bill. I commend the bill to you for your consideration. If there are any questions.
Senator, just a quickie for me, and then we'll get to you. My understanding, great work coming out of the work group in the summer. I appreciate your doing that after a discussion last time. I understand that there's an amendment in the works to deal with this, some of the concerns. I just want to make sure you are aware of that.
Mr. Chair, amendments are generally welcome. Some are even friendly.
Okay. Well, you'll hear about that from Ms. Joyce shortly. Senator?
Thank you. Senator, the question I have is, I'm sure you're aware that this bill establishes All-Terrain Vehicle Access Routes Advisory Committee, and because of that, it has to have a Ways and Means referral.
It does, yeah.
You still, I mean, you're not willing to...
I'm wanting the bill considered, but let's... I think what we need to look at is the fiscal is derived from the need to staff the working committee. And in the last iteration of this, we finessed it by getting Parks to do it on a voluntary basis. So I'm not exactly sure that we couldn't get somebody from within an agency to come forward and say, we'll do this as part of our general work plan. But I would like to see the thing analyzed at Ways and Means to find out what the fiscal really looks like. Then we can uptake the issue, and we might even be able to fund it from the industry. So,
okay, cool. More? Anybody else? Thank you very much, Senator.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate Bill 344.
It's nice to see one that looks like it's working.
Thank you.
Amy Joyce. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you, Chair Byron. Members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. Echoing much of what Senator Farioli said earlier, this did come out of that that interim work group, and there was a lot of good conversation and constructive problem solving that happened in that group. You know, these bills about ATVs on roadways have been around for years and years, and I think we're actually making some progress this go round. So a couple of, there were eight recommendations coming out of that work group, many of which are contained in the bill. The big item that the ATV access routes, coming up with connectors between trails, connectors between perhaps, you know, campgrounds and the local restaurant, gas station, that sort of thing, where these things make sense. And where they make sense will depend on a case-by-case basis, having to do with, you know, the terrain, the local community, and a number of different factors. So those are all things that made it into the bill, as well as a technical fix allowing ATVs to cross at an intersection when they're coming off of a local road where it's already allowed crossing a state highway. There's kind of a probably a holdover from way back when ATVs were never on the road. It fixes it, so now you can cross at that intersection. A couple of things didn't make it into the bill, and that's something we'd certainly like to work with Senator Farioli and Parks and others. Those were some of the safety items that were in the recommendations. So part of it had to do with equipment. So in the bill, it exempts these ATVs from the equipment requirements that you'd have on a standard motor vehicle. But a recommendation also from the work group is that then an agency would write rules for some perhaps lesser level of equipment for these ATVs. So that didn't make it into the bill, as well as some driver safety things. So driver license or permit, so we know these folks know the rules of the road. Helmets on the kind of vehicles where it makes sense. Liability insurance and a seat belt, again, on those kinds of vehicles where that makes sense. So, you know, ODOT, we're particularly concerned about safety. It's one of our core missions, and we continue to talk about that during the work group, and we continue to bring it forward here that we need to be paying attention to those safety aspects. There are a couple of smaller issues with the bill. One of them is that the bill currently has the Oregon Transportation Commission designating these routes not only on state highways but also on county roads and city streets. And I don't know that that was intended in the bill, but perhaps it wasn't intended. I would suggest that that might slow down the process for some locals who want to do this. So that might want to be looked at. And the other item is the constitutionally dedicated highway fund. So we really wrestled with this during the work group. ODOT raised it as a concern, and we thought we had worked through it. You'll see words like incidental use in the bill, and that was an attempt to get not run into constitutional problems with the highway fund. DOJ has raised it again, and we think we've got a simple fix that can be done with a small statutory change in an amendment. So, again, something we'd want to look at in an amendment. So we're here to help, and we look forward to doing that.
Okay. Questions of Amy?
I'm trying to figure out what part of the bill she liked.
Be nice, Senator. Now, I'm assuming, Amy, that you are working with Senator Farioli's office.
Senator, I have checked in with their office.
Together.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, cool. Anything else? Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
All right, I have three other people, and I think I'll call you all up at once. Ethan, I think it's Ludwig. John Omlin, maybe, and Daryl Fuller. Okay. Welcome, gentlemen. Whoever wants to go first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon Power Sports Association. We are strongly in favor of the bill. We appreciate the work that was done during the interim and Senator Farioli for introducing it. Big fans of sort of the progress we're making. I did, in reading through the bill, note one potential issue that I hope Senator Farioli would consider a friendly amendment, and if not, then I certainly don't want to consider it. But just a drafting concern on page 2, section B, down near the bottom, it says a grant of authority under paragraph A of this subsection to operate an all-terrain vehicle on an all-terrain vehicle access route is effective when signs are posted. And just in the back of my mind, that the only time there's a grant of authority, regardless of what work's been done at the county level, regardless of what hoops have been drawn, that the authority to do this is exclusively granted to whether or not there's a sign there or not. And that just makes me a little bit nervous in smaller eastern Oregon counties where maybe a sign gets stolen or a sign gets knocked down or something happens and a sign is obscure, but the statute says this is only effective if there's a sign there. And a bunch of people inadvertently get in trouble because the sign doesn't exist, just based on the way the language is. And I don't know if that's what the intent is or not. So if they're working on some amendments, I would like an opportunity to at least have them consider that, either moving the signage requirements into administrative rule and letting that be massaged later, or looking at the way that the bill is drafted and whether that's really their intent to hinge so much on this, on whether or not there happens to be a sign in that portion of a county. And with that, like I said, we're strongly in favor of the bill. Don't want anything we suggest to slow it down. Thank you for your time.
Appreciate you have that discussion with Ms. Joyce or Senator Farioli. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to testify today. actually, good to see you guys again. my name is Ethan Ludwig. I live in Eugene, Oregon. I'm a lifelong off-highway motorcycle enthusiast. I'm the current president of the Emerald Trail Riders Association. I represent the Emerald Trail Riders Association and the Oregon Motorcycle Rider Association. We would like to voice our support for SB 344. Off-highway motorcyclists support this bill because there is a growing need for off-highway motorcycle recreationalists to be able to ride on rural roads, accessing trailheads, and being able to access rural communities. Our rural communities need our recreation dollars. The satisfaction of a riding adventure is greatly enhanced when a loop route involves destinations. Being able to access restaurants and fuel in rural communities means our adventure can last all day instead of just a few hours. Being able to access lodging means we can create multi-day adventures carrying a credit card instead of 30 pounds of gear. SB 344 would help improve trail interconnectivity and reduce the concentration of OHV users. The reduced concentration of users reduces safety concerns for users. Given the multidisciplinary review process for appropriate access routes written into SB 344, we do not see the utility of limiting these opportunities to counties with a population of less than 20,000 residents. We request that the limitation be removed from the bill. As with any good piece of legislation, this bill is a compromise. At the legislators' direction, you all, off-highway vehicle stakeholders from across Oregon joined experts from numerous state agencies in multiple work sessions to craft the language that would best serve Oregon communities and recreationalists. SB 344 has incorporated many of the recommendations that are a result of this work group, which State Parks was asked to convene. If any amendments are considered to the bill moving forward, the Oregon off-highway motorcyclist community would encourage you to honor the tough deliberation, partnership, and goodwill that was exhibited by those experts and community members by referring only this work group final published recommendations for additional concepts. So basically, we feel like the SB 192 work group was very successful, and we see these recommendations in SB 344, and we just like that to continue. Okay. I certainly welcome any questions.
Thank you, kind of a mouthful. Senator.
So, Patrick, does this bill actually apply to motorcycles at all?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, dirt bikes are Class 2 all-terrain vehicles, so I suspect they would apply to Class 2 ATVs, not road-ready motorcycles, but yes.
Got it. Thank you.
Or Class 3, do I have it wrong?
Yes, Class 3.
Class 3,
sure.
Thank you.
I got it.
Been too long since I've been in the ATV.
I got it.
ATV
I just never thought of
yes.
those as
there
ATVs.
Are motorcycles to which it would apply.
Okay.
Yes, and
okay.
This bill is very helpful for if I'll go on a trip with my 13-year-old son, for example, and the work group decides that there may be a shoulder that's appropriate so that we can connect trails, it would be very helpful if the language of this bill contained the ability for us to cross a highway. I can cross a highway very safely with my 13-year-old, who's a very competent rider. Not that we want to ride down the roadway, but the ability to cross a roadway at an intersection or within 100 feet of an intersection would greatly enhance our riding opportunities.
So again, your suggestions for amendments, I would ask that you take those up with Senator Farioli's office and Amy Joyce.
Thank you, Senator.
And get them in.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is John Omelin. I am the owner of a power sports store located in Eugene, Oregon, off-highway vehicle enthusiast, a member of the Oregon State, Oregon Parks and Recreation Department Senate Bill 192 Working Group. I have a 3-year appointment with the Bureau of Land Management Resource Advisory Committee and am administrator for the Willamette Side-by-Side Riding Group, a group of over 425 side-by-side enthusiasts that self-organizes rides utilizing Facebook. I also co-sponsor the annual Willamette Side-by-Side Festival in Oak Ridge with the Chamber of Commerce. The following represents my point of view and not that of Senate Bill 192 Working Committee nor BLM. I am in support of Senate Bill 344. When we started our business 3 years ago, our customers' biggest question was where to ride. We are tired of riding in the sand. In search of the answer, I was surprised and became active in working to promote better access for OHV riding community. Oregon has some of the best riding in our nation, almost a state secret. Our national forests are truly scenic wonderlands, waterfalls, wildlife, geological wonders, pure scenic beauty, all at our doorstep, except we have an issue accessing this wonderland. Due to the nature of our landscape and history of forest management, we now have barriers to easy access. This is mainly due to our changing technologies and increasing popularity of off-highway vehicles, the barrier, pavement, and laws. Generally speaking, OHVs are not currently allowed on pavement unless a local road authority has granted access. This ability to grant access is little known and sparsely used, and due to a lack of coordination between road authorities, rules for use vary, thus creating a new barrier to accessing our riding area. As an example, one road authority may require windshield wipers if you have a full windshield, while another may not have this requirement at all. Senate Bill 344 will help set the standards and provide a process for granting access. Communities are eagerly awaiting leadership in this area with the adoption of Senate Bill 344. Confusion over standards can be addressed. More importantly, increased ridership due to easier access to riding areas will contribute to much-needed economic growth for many of our rural communities. I would recommend the following modifications to the proposed bill. 1. Require drivers to have liability insurance. 2. Require drivers to be at least 16 years old with valid driver's license unless directly supervised by a licensed driver. And I think I misquoted number 1, which was to require to have liability insurance, not driver's license. I would like to see Section 3AA, lines 35 through 38, amended, which only pertains to counties that have a population of 20,000 or fewer, as communities such as Oak Ridge could benefit from this provision also. Thank you for your opportunity to testify before you today and positive consideration for this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Any questions of this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much, gentlemen. That's all I had signed up. Is anybody else who wanted to testify on Senate Bill 344? Seeing none, we've, as you heard, we have need for an amendment and some. Oops.
Yeah, I want to, before I decide whether I can support this or not, I want to see the amendment that Amy is preparing to make sure that there's nothing in this measure that would make our state less safe.
Hear you. Okay. All righty. So we will close and we'll, Senator, we'll leave it in your capable hands to come up with it. Thank you very much for bringing it. We'll close on that. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 381. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 381 requires certain notices related to real estate loans to be mailed to all addresses on file to the recipient, including to post office boxes. This measure has no amendment before us, Mr. Chair. The measure, as written, has no fiscal revenue impact, Mr. Chair, so if the committee chooses, it's available.
Ready to go. Senator, welcome.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Hansel, State Senator for District 29. Thank you for the opportunity to speak regarding Senate Bill 381. I thought it might be helpful to give you some background on how this bill came about. Typically, people receive mail at their physical address. However, for people living in rural communities, including myself, we receive our mail at a post office box, not a street address. We also have street addresses, but we don't get our mail there. When mail is addressed to the street address instead of the P.O. box, the postmaster will not deliver the piece of mail and is returned to sender. I was contacted by a former mayor of Adams, Oregon, who spoke to me about a major problem he experienced. He was called by his out-of-state financial institution that his home was being foreclosed. The foreclosure came as a complete shock to him. Turns out he had not received any of the letters warning of this foreclosure. This was because he used a P.O. box. His payment schedule had been changed, so his payments, while paid, were inadequate. And since the bank sent their warning letters to his street address, he did not receive any of this correspondence. As the deficit began to grow, the bank sent him more warnings, but none were actually delivered to him. He had absolutely no idea there was a problem. Then he was notified by phone that his house was going to be foreclosed in a few days. My pastor, who moved to Athena, my hometown, from Arizona, had a similar issue with a loan that he was paying back while in Tucson. What Senate Bill 381 does is, if the P.O. box is listed as a mailing address along with a physical address, the lending institution must send it notices to it as well for loan foreclosure documents. Although some might view this bill to be minor, by passing Senate Bill 381, we can ensure that events similar to the ones experienced by the Adams mayor or my pastor or many others in rural Oregon will not happen again. My preference would be to include all legal documents, but legislative council felt it might be too complicated to do at this time, so Senate Bill 381 only includes foreclosures. Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for taking time to hear Senate Bill 381. And I urge you to do pass recommendation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator. Questions? I see none. Thank you.
Okay.
We'll see what we can do. Is there somebody?
That's the only person.
There's no one?
There's no one else, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on Senate Bill 381? Seeing none, we will close public hearing. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 381. Senator.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 381 to the floor with a do not pass recommendation.
I mean, do pass, sorry.
He's one of yours.
Sorry.
Senator Thompson has moved Senate Bill 381 to the floor with the do pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion, Senator?
Yeah, I have a P.O. box, and I don't like mail going to my mailbox because crime is a problem out where I'm at, and your mailbox just isn't safe. So I think this is an escalating problem, especially in rural Oregon, and so I'd encourage you to ask
them. You like it. Is there any objection to the bill? There is none. Senate Bill 381 goes to the floor for the due pass. And Senator Hansel, would you like to carry that?
I'd be honored. Thank you.
What? Well, happy down. We will close on Senate Bill 381. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 382. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 382 increases from $100,000 to $500,000 the threshold contract price at which a contracting agency is allowed to directly appoint an architect, engineer, photogrammetrist, transportation planner, or land surveyor. It becomes effective January 1st, but takes effect 91st day following signee die. We do have before you and on OLIS the -1 amendment. The -1 amendment defines the term price of a consultant service and creates provisions for a pre-qualification process for proposal submission, which and modifies the allowance for direct appointment for cases of in an emergency or if the estimated cost of service does not exceed $100,000, Mr. Chair.
Senator, did you want to talk on this one too?
I would be pleased to.
Well, there you go.
I just thought he was going to sit here all afternoon.
I thought he liked it so well he was going to stay.
I thought you'd have to tell him to leave.
Senator Hansen, would you please?
Thank you, Chairman Beyer and members of the committee. For the record, my name is still Bill Hansel. I'm still the state senator for District 29 in Northeast Oregon. I introduced Senate Bill 382 to help start a conversation and in the hopes of finding solutions to concerns that have been expressed by a number of municipalities over the required use of qualification-based selection for the procurement of professional services. In the context of this issue, the current law of professional services includes architectural, engineering, photogrammetric mapping, transportation planning, and land survey services. Qualification-based selection requirements are outlined in statute and prohibit contracting agencies, including local governments, from considering price until after they have been selected, after they have selected a proposal for a professional service contract. Existing statute combines with administrative rules requires government to select firms using an informal qualification-based selection process for projects under $250,000. For projects over $250,000, a more rigorous formal qualification-based selection process must be used. Neither process, informal or formal, allows for the municipality to consider any pricing information until after they have selected a firm. Once they select a firm based on qualifications alone, they can enter into negotiations for price with a selected firm. If the entities are unable to come to an agreement on a feasible price, the municipality can terminate the negotiations and move on to the second highest ranked firm, and so on and so forth. Current law also allows for direct appointment of a contractor for projects under $100,000. However, it is important to note that the direct appointment process still does not allow for competitive bidding or pricing, as you are dealing with only one contractor. QBS, Qualified Based Solutions, prevents state and local governments from comparing pricing information from bidders before they start the winning firm, before they select the winning firm. I don't know about you, but I'm perplexed by the idea that we as a legislature are telling procurement professionals that they can't consider price or compare pricing information of competing firms at any level before selecting a consultant. The conversation that local governments want to have is whether this requirement is working as promised by the mandatory QBS that was passed in the 2011 session, and whether QBS is intended to prevent the awarding of contracts to unqualified firms, or if it truly intended to guide them towards selecting the most qualified firm. Preventing poor quality work from being performed is certainly in the best interest of local governments, as they are accountable to the citizens and taxpayers. They have a fiduciary responsibility to ensure both quality and highest and best use of limited taxpayers' dollars. In other words, it is the local procurement professional's job to get the best value for the public. The notice of hiring the most qualified firm is a challenging one. There may be multiple firms that are amply qualified for a project, but many have different strengths and different approaches. If a municipality chooses firm A over firm B, it doesn't necessarily mean that firm B is not equally qualified or potentially more qualified in certain aspects of their proposal. We can't legislate the hiring of the most qualified firm because there are simply too many variables at play, and frankly, that's why we have professionals in local government to make those determinations. What we can do is to work to ensure that the state law doesn't artificially hamstring local officials in doing their job to deliver projects that represent the best overall value to taxpayers. That is why I introduce Senate Bill 382. After speaking with Tracy Rutten of the League of Oregon Cities, who has been working with us on this bill, we decided to seek the Dash 1 amendments. LOC is here in the room to explain the Dash 1 amendments in detail, and they would be happy to answer any and all questions you might have. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to bring this before your committee.
Thank you, Senator. Questions? Don't see any. We'll let you go back to committee.
Thank you.
Unless you have another bill that you wanted to talk about.
Not today.
Thanks for coming. All righty, Tracy.
If I can get out of here.
You want a panel with, is it Andy Smith and Mike Fott? Oh, good. Okay. Okay, not for the moment.
Okay.
Please.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, Tracy Rutten with the League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on Senate Bill 382, and more specifically on the Dash 1 amendments that are before you today. I also want to thank Senator Hansel and his staff for introducing this bill, as well as Representative Olson and Representative Johnson for their sponsorship of the legislation before you. The League of Oregon Cities requested introduction of this bill, Senate Bill 382, following our policy committee process last spring. During that process, the issue of mandated use of qualification-based selection for the procurement of professional services was addressed as a concern by a number of our cities. The issue was ultimately forwarded on as a potential recommended priority for consideration by our membership. And in August, our board of directors directed the League of Oregon Cities and staff to continue to pursue the issue and concerns that were indicated by our membership about the mandated use of QBS in the procurement of professional services. We introduced this bill in an effort to really begin conversations with those who have historically been supportive of use of QBS in the past, primarily the associations representing the architects as well as the engineers. In November, we had our first meeting between local government representatives and representatives of the American Council of Engineering Companies of Oregon. We have also engaged in conversations with the architects. We've now had three meetings with ACEC since our first meeting that we had back in November. I really do want to express our appreciation to ACEC. I think that the conversations have been far more productive than I had actually anticipated throughout this process. We have our next meeting with ACEC actually scheduled for this coming Friday. So to be really honest, this hearing caught us a little off guard, but I think it provides for a good opportunity for us to frame the issue, to talk about some of the challenges that we've discussed with the various entities at the table. So I think that, you know, hopefully this will continue us down the path of trying to find some reasonable solutions moving forward. Again, I think the meetings with ACEC have been really helpful in terms of better understanding each other's positions on the issues, and hopefully they're open to continuing that dialogue moving forward. I want to note that it's, from our perspective, important to indicate to you today that we are not interested in a conversation about a solely low bid approach for professional services contracts. As local governments, we want to acquire the best value for our constituents. We believe that in order to find the best value, qualifications and price both need to play a role in the decision making. We do not believe that price and qualifications are mutually exclusive when you talk about overall value, and we're interested in finding a way that we can appropriately balance both price and qualifications in order to lend itself to the best overall value when we make these types of contracting decisions. I believe the city of Beaverton will testify in probably more detail as to the Dash 1 amendments that are before you today. But essentially what the Dash 1 amendments do is they increase the threshold for the use of formal QBS versus the use of what's known as informal QBS process. Under current law, the threshold is $250,000. Really is actually spelled out in administrative rules. The main difference between informal and formal QBS is how many prospective bidders that you end up advertising to. But under either process, formal or informal, price cannot be considered. So we'd like to talk about increasing the threshold, certainly, so local governments can have additional flexibility in determining if and when QBS is appropriate for a given project. The threshold in the Dash 1 amendments is $500,000. The amendment also makes changes to the informal QBS process, if you will, so that any project that is under $500,000 would continue to result in qualifications being the primary driver or consideration by local governments, with the price weighing in as no more than one-third of the overall scoring. So again, what we're trying to do here is balance, find that right balance between qualifications, make sure that's still the primary driver. We're not interested in poor quality work moving forward. What we're interested in is finding the best value. And in our opinion, value means qualifications, absolutely, but it also means price. And thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Hear from the whole panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name's Andy Smith. I'm the Government Relations Manager for the City of Hillsborough. Thanks for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 382 today. I'm here just to walk you through this PowerPoint presentation. It's short, I promise, and I won't read the slides, so I'll click right through it. But it just gives you a brief history of where this issue came from and how it came into law in Oregon. Qualification-based selection is a process for buying specifically architectural, engineering, photogrammetric mapping, transportation planning, and land surveying services. Generally, how it works is a public agency has a project. We send out an RFP, RFQ, interchangeable terms for QBS. We receive qualifications back from interested firms. We create a rank-ordered list of qualified firms from most qualified to least qualified, and then we select the most qualified firm for the job. At that point, we can negotiate scope of work, budget, and ultimately price. And then if we can't come to terms on the price with the first firm, we get to go to the next most qualified firm and have the same conversation that we had with the first firm. And I'll just note that if the second firm comes in at a higher price than the first firm, then we are precluded under current law from going back and signing a contract with the most qualified firm. So where did it come from? It's federal in origin. Many states have adopted their own versions of federal law. It varies from state to state. Some have it only for state contracting agencies. Some have it for both state and local. In Oregon, before January 1st, 2012, it was only for state contracting agencies, and it applied to local projects that included a certain mix of state funding. But in 2011, House Bill 3316 passed, and that made qualification-based selection mandatory for state and local projects. And then DOJ promulgated rules that implemented that measure. And so, you know, how does the law work? Well, it's really quite complicated, actually, but that's the basics on how it works. And I think Tracy did a good job of kind of explaining the differences on those three levels. So I won't go into any detail there. So these next couple slides just kind of highlight why we think this committee should consider the policy behind QBS. And the first reason, and what this slide highlights, is that QBS is a complete outlier in the public contracting code. And as you can see in the very first point there on 279A015, 279A being the overarching statute for public contracting, in subsection 3, it says a responsive public contracting system should promote efficient use of state and local government resources. And you'll hear testimony today from experts who do the work who will tell you that QBS is not achieving that policy goal. In subsection 5, you'll see that for buying all other professional services in 279B, price is a part of arriving at best value. And there's some really important public professional services that we buy that are not those services covered by QBS, like accountants, lawyers, doctors, just to name a few. And then I'll go right to the last point there. 279C305 lays out the policy for the rest of 279C and the policy for all other construction services, which is least cost. And so I think that there's a policy question there about is it right to insulate one section of the contracting community from the least cost policy? Next point is time is money in public contracting, and you'll hear expert testimony today about why QBS is clunky, time-consuming, and costly for local governments. We also don't think that QBS always achieves best value or guarantees best value, and the expert testimony will go a little bit more into detail about why that's the case. So Tracy mentioned we've been meeting with ACEC for a number of months, and again, we really appreciate their engagement with us. It has been very valuable, and I don't want to undermine that at all. And we do agree on some broad points, and none of us think that selecting a highly qualified firm is a top priority for public projects. We all think that QBS can be a useful tool in certain circumstances, and I would say we probably think in certain circumstances more than they do. But we also think that price should never be the only criteria on which we procure professional services, and it shouldn't even be the overarching decision-making point for procuring those services. But I will say that, we have some fundamental disagreements. And one of the things that came up in our negotiations and discussions with ACEC is that, we just need to have better education for public contracting officials around the state. QBS is really quite flexible, and we can achieve all the things that we're having problems with if we just are better educated about how to do it. And our response to that has been, well, if that's the case, then let's work on language that codifies the flexibility. Because I think the reality is that public contracting professionals, public works professionals, purchasing managers around the state, and the attorneys that advise them are going to look at the law and how to advise their clients. And we think, education could be a part of the picture, but it can't be the only thing that solves this problem. And of course, we have a fundamental disagreement on whether price can be a factor at all prior to selection. So that brings us to Senate Bill 382. Really, we're trying to make one basic change to this section of law. We want to maintain that existing $100,000 threshold for direct appointments, and we want to create a new threshold of $500,000 under which price can be considered for the procurement of professional services under certain circumstances. And as Tracy mentioned, one of the ways that we're trying to be responsive to the concerns from our friends at ACEC that price will be the overriding and always the decision point is to actually put the weight in statute. And we have it at 30%. We have the threshold at 500,000. We've been clear with them that we're open to negotiations and feedback on what those numbers should be. To this point, we haven't received any feedback at all, but want to indicate that we are perfectly open to having a conversation about how we can come to the middle and move the ball forward and address some of the unintended consequences that have occurred over the years for public agencies. And with that, I'll close. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name, excuse me, is Mike Butt. I'm the Public Works Director for the City of Ashland. And I really want to talk about impacts to purchasing rules for small communities. And again, Ashland's about 21,000, and while that may not seem like a small community, from a staffing perspective, our engineering staff is, we essentially have five members of our staff, four of which are project managers. So think about the variety of disciplines or projects that we're responsible for, water, sewer, transportation, stormwater, and think about the multitude with all the capital projects we have, the multitude of RFPs we have to write and send out for bid, again, with a limited staff. I previously was a public works director in Staten, and I had a staff of one engineering tech. Again, every community has all these disciplines. And so the impact, I just want to talk a little bit about the fact that when you use QBS, for smaller projects, and again, less than 500,000, the time that goes into these projects really impacts our ability to prioritize our projects and deliver all the projects that we have in the queue, if you will, or that are in the capital improvement project list. So it just gives you some time frames. And again, I want to put this in perspective. We want the best quality, and we also want the best price. If we're just looking at some of the smaller projects, our staff's looking at 1 to 3 months to negotiate. So we have to go through the process. We can't consider price, which I want to speak to in just a minute. We may spend 1 to 3 months on that process, and if price doesn't work out, then we go to the next bidder and we start down that same road working on the price. And I think, as you heard previously, if that price is not less than, we can't go back to the previous bidder. again, that takes time. It takes time for us to complete our projects. On the larger projects, it can take anywhere from 6 to 12 months to do that. We have one project, it's a new water plant in the $20 million range. It's going to be about $1.4 million in engineering. We spent a year negotiating that. The good news is that we come to terms with that bidder, but if we hadn't, we'd begin that whole process over again. Now, we really think, having said that, on the QBS over 500,000, we think that process worked really well for this large project. We really had some value engineering going into that long-term conversation at that level. Most of the other projects, it's fairly simple to write an RFP and get the details out there, at least in my perspective. And so we're requesting that these changes. But the context for me that I want to share with you is that when I take a project or I take a list of capital projects to the community, I'm the one that also has to take the recommended rate increases, the correlating rate increases. And if I can't use pricing as a way to get the most effective price along with the quality, we're really, I think, in a difficult spot. And then, and I'm talking about my impact when I'm in front of the community, then I take this to the council, then it's their job to try to get those prices passed. And it's really difficult when we say, well, you know, here's our estimated cost, but we really can't nail down the engineering piece of it. So I just think there are some unintended consequences. I think on smaller projects that don't need to happen, and then again, I do want to say this threshold above that, I think the process works and can work fairly well if we can sort out the flexibility and make that clearer. So, and I just want to leave it at that, if I can.
Thank you. Questions, Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. couple of things. The 100,000 or 500,000 that we're talking about, that's not the project cost, is it? That's the piece of that's just the engineering, or is that correct?
That's correct.
Chair Byers, Senator Riley, that is correct, that aspect. And I just want to make sure and clarify, too, on the $100,000 for direct appoint, the Dash 1 amendments would leave that $100,000 threshold for direct appointment, which allows you to just directly, you know, contact somebody you've worked with previously and use that person again. And then the $500,000 is on the QBS side of that. But, yes, you are correct that would be the cost for the architectural engineering services or otherwise.
Well, not for the entire
And not for the entirety of the project.
Another question, and it seems to me this may be what you're doing may be a possible solution, but it seems to me it's not the biggest problem. One of the biggest problems I see is once you've gone to that second person, you can't go back. That really struck me as much more important to me. It seemed like it. What do you?
Mr. Chair and Senator Riley, I mean, I think that's one component of some changes that we need to make to a very complicated system of procuring public professional services. But I do think that that's a critical factor. But there are some clarifications, and I think, like I mentioned before, there are some things that our friends at ACEC say it does in terms of flexibility that we think we should just put in statute so that everybody knows the rules of the game across the state, and so that's clear. But we do agree with your point.
And if I may, Senator Beyer and Chair Beyer, Senator Riley, that issue actually was something that one of our cities did bring forward as a recommendation. So it's certainly, again, we're looking for any solutions to further, you know, simplify this process and kind of bring in all those aspects. And I think that certainly is something that we would be interested to talk more about.
Anybody else?
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
So, next
slide. Seems silly to kick
off. Okay, so, Karen, hit him. I've got my glasses on. I'm having it wrong. Come on up. You know who you are. Kurt Wilson and Marshall. Go by. Welcome. Yep.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Marshall Koba, representing the American Council of Engineering Companies. Please excuse my scratchy voice this afternoon, but we're here today in opposition to Senate Bill 382. We have had conversations with our local government friends and clients. We met with them on November 30th, on January 10th, on February 10th, and we're going to meet again with them on Friday, and then this bill was scheduled. So I think this is an interesting opportunity, and we're going to take this opportunity to educate the Senate Business Committee today. I think this is a great opportunity for you to better understand, from our perspective, what it is that we're talking about. And I've got two professionals with me that are actually hired through the QBS process. So I've got some comments, but I'll try to be brief. ACEC represents more than 120 member firms across the state and about 3,500 employees. Our members range from small, locally owned firms to major companies providing design services to public and private clients across the nation and the world. Our members are united in opposition to this drastic and unnecessary decimation, we believe, of the current QBS law. We have a longstanding policy in supporting the use of QBS by federal, state, and local governments, and continual education of both our members and our clients, local and state governments, to the many benefits that accrue to taxpayers, owners, projects, through design and construction, and through the life cycle cost. And I think that's important as we look at what we're talking about here. The life cycle cost of projects can be 50, 75, 100-year life cycles. Good design on the front end will help with maintenance and everything else that goes into a building. Senate Bill 382 would have a major negative impact on the number of projects that would be required to use QBS, and would have a negative impact on small, minority, and women-owned firms who are seeking more and better opportunities. We thank you for this opportunity to present our position, and as I said, we strongly support the current law as written. QBS has become the model procurement method for professional design services across the country and is a proven procurement method. It is the best practice. It is the industry standard, and I will get to that shortly. Interestingly, House Bill 3316 was referenced in the slides a minute ago. In 2011, that bill passed 57-1 in the House and 28-2 in the Senate. Current law requires QBS to be used for all state and local procurements of design professionals and for local governments to use QBS procurement process when the total cost of design fees, and I'm glad that was Senator Riley for clarifying that. There's a lot of conversation about cost, but it's the design fees that we're talking about here, $100,000. Since design fees typically represent 10% of a project cost through construction, the direct appointment process is for projects up to approximately $1 million. The amendments that are being talked about here, which I just saw today, there's been some conversation, but I hadn't seen the amendments until today. To stay on the direct appointment process, recently, prior to the last legislation in 2011, the direct appointment process was $50,000. So it doubled in House Bill 3316. Senate Bill 382 proposes to raise the threshold to $500,000 of design fees, which would be a $5 million project. And for many local governments, that is a substantial project. And this is a major step in the wrong direction. I'm going to skip some of my points here to move through here, but I want to make sure there's two groups. For sure, the American Public Works Association supports the use of QBS. APWA believes that, and this is their policy statement, APWA, the American Public Works Association, the professional organization of public works professionals, believes that the public interest is best served when government agencies select architects, engineers, and related professional technical consultants for projects and studies through QBS procedures. Basing selections on qualifications and competence rather than price fosters greater creativity and flexibility and minimizes the potential for disputes and litigation. There's also a very strong, similarly worded statement from the American Bar Association, which also talks about less litigation and less change orders. The importance of quality design cannot be overstated. Every project is unique with its own technical challenges, and at the outset of many projects, it is sometimes difficult for the owner to fully grasp the complexities of the project or the variety of services that may be required to develop a solution. The qualified design professional fills these needs for the owner. And QBS has proven to foster the relationship by bringing the owner and the design professional together as a team, which is a key ingredient to quality and to value, enabling them to define the scope of work in detail. And Karen and Kurt will talk to that more, but the scope of work is the key and really what this whole issue is about. QBS is a process that is easily adapted to any project, large or small, and it gives the public owner, in this case local governments, a partner that they will work with us, the design professional, the project in detail and agree on all of the services that will be required for the completion of the project. Over the years, and going back 30 years, I've got documents going back to 86. We've worked closely with local governments to educate them on the benefits of QBS. I'd like to pull up one of our early, a nice three-ring binder manual, and it was a voluntary program back then, and who can forget a floppy disk? We had the documents on a floppy disk. This was put together in 1994 and sent out to local governments as an educational tool. We oppose Senate Bill 382 and any potential amendments that we believe will roll back project types or sizes that are currently required to use QBS. As I mentioned to all of you, we are once again expressing our commitment to work closely with each and every local government and their associations to educate them and their members to the benefits of QBS. I appreciate the comments from the proponents of the bill about the quality of our conversation. I just want you to know that we have met with them three times. I brought my A-team, three of my past presidents, and my current president, who's sitting next to me today. I couldn't have better people in the room, and so we've had quality conversation from quality representatives of quality firms about the importance and about what we think is valuable to qualification-based selection. We need educated public owners to work with us through this process, and these are our clients, and it's important they understand and appreciate how QBS is beneficial to their limited and valuable public works funds. Our commitment to education is real and a pledge we will not back away from, because we feel if they are not comfortable with QBS, then we are no better off than we are today. So to that end, I mean, this is something, and I showed a couple of you this. I mean, it's a long and extensive PowerPoint presentation that can be taken on the road, and we're happy to share it with people. But we've got qualified people, interested members of our association, and the architects who are interested and willing, and we've got local government folks as well that would participate in that educational effort. So to wrap this up, we respectfully ask you to oppose Senate Bill 382 as written, or any potential amendments that will make less projects use qualification-based selection. We thank you for this hearing, and hopefully that we can enlighten you some more. With me today is Karen Tapman from Quincy Engineering here in Salem, and she's the current president of ACEC Oregon.
Thank you so much. Thank you, committee, for allowing me to speak today. Like Marshall, I think it's very important that all elected officials, public officials, and procurement staff understand QBS and why it's the best method to be used for hiring architects and engineers. Personally, I am a project manager. I've been doing transportation projects for more than 30 years. It's kind of scary to say that, but 30 years. Currently, I'm a managing principal at Quincy Engineering here in Salem. We do nothing but publicly funded transportation projects. So I live and my company thrives in the QBS environment because it allows us to compete against firms of all sizes. My firm employs 10 engineers here in Salem, and overall we're a company of about 70, so I'd call us a medium-sized firm. As Marshall pointed out, I'm currently the president of ACEC Oregon and proud to be so, but most importantly, I wear a lot of hats, but most importantly, I'm an Oregon taxpayer, and that is really how I look at this as an engineer and as a taxpayer. It's important to understand that QBS is merely a process. You can apply it, an agency can apply it as they see fit to their individual project, so they can meet the needs of their project. It's been presented as a complicated process. It's really not complicated. You decide you have a project, you decide what criteria is most important to you, you put that out in an RFP, you get the responses, you score them, pick number one, talk about the work that needs to be done and develop a statement of work, negotiate the cost, get them under contract, and then you go do the work. So again, really not complicated. And cost is not ignored. Cost should not be ignored. It just doesn't come up at the front end. So why is cost not at the front end? Why is it later? Well, it's really important to agree that until you have a meeting of the minds on what the project is and what work is required, any cost proposal isn't real. So agencies that ask for a cost proposal as part of the proposal submittal process have a false sense of security. I've never met a draft scope of work in an RFP that held through the negotiation process in my 30 years. Doesn't happen. And once price is set, expectations are set. And as an engineering firm that provides a service and relies on customer service, we're in it with our clients for the long haul. It's not about an individual project. It's about a long-term relationship. So we're celebrating our 25th anniversary this year as a transportation firm. Again, that's all we do is publicly funded projects. We've never not negotiated a price in 25 years. So it doesn't happen. Why do you talk about scope of work first and then cost? Because that's what's most efficient. The agency presents what they believe is a scope of work, and that's a starting point. Then we work together to refine. What will the agency do? What do they need a consultant to do? Because oftentimes it's a blended team. Consultant will ask questions, we'll get clarification, we'll offer suggestions, not just from recent projects, but from other clients, and perhaps even other clients from other states that we can bring to the table. Like I said, consultants don't walk from projects if they're smart, because it's about the long-term relationship. The best design responds to the owner's needs, and in the long run, that saves time and money. And the true cost of a project is measured in its construction costs and its maintenance and operation costs. So if you focus a lot of energy on what it costs to hire a consulting firm, you're sort of focusing on a small piece of the puzzle. So we've been asked, the agencies put the statement of work in the RFP. Isn't that enough to set a price? As I said, the first scope of work in an RFP is rarely close enough to negotiate and set a price. There's a lot of unknowns. Firms like mine have to make assumptions when things are missing. There's a lot of what if questions. What if this were to happen? What if that were to happen? Well, you think, okay, well, just identify in your proposal, put it in as a contingency. These things might happen. If we identified all the what-if scenarios and we were scored based on price, every time we add in a contingency or something that might happen, we're just building on the price. So it's a losing game for us to go that route. And we were asked, why won't firms ask questions to clarify the scope of work? It isn't clear. Ask a question. Well, when you're going through a qualifications-based selection, you're trying to show that you have the best approach, the smartest people, the right team to deliver a project efficiently. So the more questions you ask, those questions are sent out to everyone who's looking at the RFP. So you've just, more questions, just divulge all your secrets, so you don't do that. People don't do that. That's not how you win. When price is a criteria, firms will tell clients what they want to hear to win the project and then go in and deal with what really needs to happen later. Again, it's just a false sense of security. We heard another thing, and that's aren't projects that are the same, aren't they just the same everywhere? So if you're going to build, if I need a 200-foot-long retaining wall, I mean, come on, how different can it be? Retaining walls kind of feel like commodities. Well, when you think through all the possibilities, they're not. There's different geology. Some clients want concrete. Some clients want steel. Some want specialty formwork. We even did one where truly the best solution related to a type of retaining wall that could be done so quickly to solve a problem before the first school buses came through on the first day of school. That's what drove the best solution. That's how unique projects can be. The scope of work is different. The price is different. And so I want to make that point. Agencies think that many firms are essentially equal, and we heard that today. So it's price that sets them apart. I think agencies should be more concerned about value and value for the taxpayers than just the lowest price. Again, value is the project as a whole, not just what you're paying up front for a design fee. So what creates value for an agency? It's things like a consultant project manager that can work best with an agency project manager. So it's that relationship, tried and true. It's a qualified technical team that knows how to go out and get the permits, manage the stormwater. It's a team that can commit to the schedule when schedule is a driving factor. More importantly, a team that can foresee and respond to challenges and changes that will occur. A chief engineer at ODOT told me one time, design is a process of discovery. And man, in my 30 years, I could not agree more with that. You don't know until you get into it. There's just things that you're going to discover. So don't ask for price. Ask a team, what are the biggest hurdles that I'm likely to face, and what can you do to help me get through them? Value is determined by the right team on the project, not the lowest price team on the project. And I thought about this and thought, for agencies who really want the lowest price, when they think about what staff they're going to assign to the project internally, who do they assign? Their least expensive, lowest paid project manager? As a taxpayer, I hope not. The person they assign is the most qualified, available, experienced for that project. And again, as a taxpayer, I hope that's what they do, because as a firm, that's what we do too. I want agencies to use the project criteria to identify the firm that provides the best value, the firm that shows the ability to efficiently deliver the most effective project given all the factors involved. And those factors are defined by the client, not by us. I know it's difficult as a public works director to stand in front of elected officials and ask, why didn't you hire the lowest price firm? Or is this the lowest price firm? I think a good engineer and a good public official should be able to justify who they choose based on value, because they know the project best. Firm X or Y is best for this project because. And our fees, generally an industry standard, is that our fees are generally 10% of the construction costs and a very small portion of the long-term maintenance and operation costs. And again, focus on what's the right project for the taxpayers. It's not about this small fee. So what does Senate Bill 382 mean to Quincy Engineering? A third of our projects are under $100,000 and typically direct appointed to us, because we do have a client base and we do a lot of bridge work and people hire us to do the right project. Those are million-dollar projects. So while that feels like a small project as a taxpayer, a million-dollar project does not feel small to me and my budget and my bank account. When you raise a threshold and start dealing with price up to $500,000, that's a $5 million project that won't be subject to QBS because it enters price. As Marshall said, that actually just decimates QBS. Lastly, I truly do appreciate the conversations with League of Oregon Cities. I learned a lot. I learned a lot from them. I think they learned a lot from the folks on our side as well, and we need to continue to have that conversation. But to that end, the best conversation we can have is to continue to educate, listen to their real life stories, and try to help them resolve those. We don't need a law change. We need to educate everyone on the process. There's a lot of turnover in agencies, but I know QBS is the best process for taxpayers like me. Agencies have all the control, and we just need to help them use it for what's right for taxpayers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, and members of the community. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Kurt Wilson. I live in Eugene, and I'm one of the managing partners at Pivot Architecture, a Eugene-based architecture and interiors design firm that works in Oregon. Well, throughout Oregon. One of our most significant projects in 2007 was the renovation of the House and Senate wings here at the Capitol. So I'm very hopeful that you enjoy the space that you're in, and we appreciate the opportunity to do that project. I also serve as a Vice President for Legislative Affairs for AI Oregon. I'm here to discuss the benefits of the qualification-based selection process for Oregon businesses and why Senate Bill 382 is harmful for Oregon architects and our firms. As has been noted before, QBS is a relatively new requirement in Oregon, so most of my time in practice, I've seen the impacts of including fees in the selection process. And while I appreciate the efforts of our colleagues here to meet with the League of Oregon Cities and all of their efforts, we understand, and what we've seen from history is that when you ask for fees, it becomes a bidding process, regardless of how you factor in your selection criteria. It's been also mentioned the threshold of 100,000 is intended, or the term is used for a direct appointment. In practice, it's often that for projects with an expected fee of under 100,000, an RFP will go out to multiple firms, and they will select, they'll request regular proposals like you would for any size project with the inclusion of fees. We're seeing that all the time, and this functionally results in a bidding process. So with all due respect, this ultimately leads to a low bid bidding process. It's not an easy time to be an architect or an engineer. Construction costs are rising faster than the rate of general inflation, which causes multiple pressures on our businesses. More and more of our time is spent, our project time is spent designing around these rising construction costs. In addition, public sector spending on capital projects, which is a significant source for many of our firms and their employees, and is less than what it used to be, and it's certainly going to continue to go down. The recession was not friendly to those in the design and construction industry, and the negative impacts remain, even though we are something like 75 consecutive months of an improving economy. I just don't think it feels that way right now. Add to this our growing wages for our employees, more and more technology costs, and employee-related requirements and other expenses. Our cost to do business keeps rising, opportunities remain low, the requirements on every project grows, but the pressure to drive down our fees continue. Senate Bill 382, which really will incorporate a low bid mentality, will continue to drive down fees and harm architecture and engineering firms. I want to address the role of price within the selection process. While the proponents say this is not a bidding process and there's a cap of 30% in the selection criteria, 33%, and it's just one of the factors to be considered, its actual effect in practice has actually been worse than bidding. Most of the criteria used in the selection process, such as firm history, project experience, and proposed work process, is subjective. Price is not subjective. All too often, with an understanding of the proposed price, the other factors are scored through that filter. When someone's reviewing a proposal, they see firm history on one page, experience on the other, cost on the next page. There's no way that they can evaluate a proposal and not think about cost. So to say that it's got a limited applicability to the selection process is simply not what happens. Another scenario is when the proposed fee from a firm that isn't selected is used as leverage to negotiate with a firm that has scored the highest. Too often our members hear, "We think you are the best fit for the project, but to get the job, you need to accept their fee." However, there's no effort, typically when that is done, to try and align the scope of work that one fee proposed to do and the fee that the other firm proposed to do. And at a very fundamental basis, that's the biggest problem with requesting pricing in this process, is you're decoupling what you say you're going to do and what your qualifications are from what the price is or the compensation that you're going to get to do that work. The proponents of this, so most of what I've said, I have to say here, has been covered, so I don't want to spend too much more of your time. I just want to stress QBS is used currently in most states and for a long time has been used by the federal government. Public and private owners use this proven selection system because it ensures that the most appropriate team is selected to design their project and to represent them during the construction of the facilities. One of the challenges all parties have when selecting their design team is determining the appropriate scope for the project. When we're selected, the building isn't designed yet. We don't know what it's going to be, and neither does the client. There are so many variables that go into the determination, such as the size of the building, the number of stories, site constraints. Really important factor is the level of decision-making, public involvement, and those kind of consideration, sustainable strategies. So when you're asking to bid fees at the very beginning, Obviously, you're going to reduce your scope to get the work, which means you're going to limit your services that you provide to deal with these variables that you just don't fully understand yet, and quite often, neither does the client. Bidding of fees does not allow for an appropriate level of collaboration and coordination of the services that would be provided. The QBS system is based on a two-tier process. Select the most appropriate team, and I use that term, most appropriate team, as opposed to the most qualified team. They're different, and it's part of the educational process that Marshall talked about. It's not about who's done the very most of a building type. Who's done enough to understand what's needed, and also what's the right fit for that client, for that project, and what a particular team provides. But you find the right team, and then you work together to develop the scope and compensation. Doing this properly sometimes does take time, as has been stated before, but there are certainly ways to speed that up. There are also hurdles in place, such as not being able to go back to a first proposer. That doesn't benefit anybody. That ought to be looked at. There are certainly opportunities to improve the situation, as it is now, so more smaller firms, emerging businesses, can get access through the qualification-based selection system. So we see that there's opportunities for improvement. But at a very basic level, what's being stated here today is that there's no way to know what a budget ought to be for a project. Every project I've ever negotiated a fee with, the client knew beforehand what they were going to spend or what their upper limit was that they were going to spend or the range that they were going to spend. Working through the qualification-based selection process doesn't mean you don't consider price. It means it's set done in a second stage. And so you still can end up with good value. But as Karen stated, at the end of the day, what we're doing is providing design and documentation work to support construction projects. The value of our services are in the range of 10 to 12% of the cost of construction. And so the reason why QBS is used first by so many states and by the federal government, it's just a better process to make sure that there's a good alignment of the scope of services that you're expected to provide to do the right job and what your compensation is going to be. So I urge you to vote no on Senate Bill 382. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. We've kind of gone pretty long, a lot longer than we thought on this topic, so we're going to send Senate Bill 97 and 98. We're going to have to reschedule.
Carry over?
Oh, we won't be carrying over, Mr. Chair, if I may, because we won't be doing them on Monday. We'll be finding another date somewhere in the future.
You're right. Okay. So stay tuned on those two bills. Thank you. Next up, we've got three more people that are listed to testify. So, Mr. Fuller, Mr. Kirby, and Mike Besner. Besner.
Third. Look at that left.
There was one. He's coming right there. Okay. So we've heard everything about six times.
I will be brief.
Okay, great.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Besner. I'm the Assistant Director of Transportation for Clackamas County, one of the public works officials in the state, and I do support this bill and the amendment along with the League of Oregon Cities and Association of Oregon Counties. The one thing I want to add, so I've been doing this 18 years with Clackamas County. I've been procuring work for 18 years. Before the law changed, 5 years ago, we usually did use price as 10%, which is mostly a qualification-based process. And what it told us was we're hiring the best firms. And then we had a little tiebreaker at the end where value actually included just a little bit of cost to make sure we weren't going to overpay for our services. And it worked very, very well for Clackamas County, and we did millions of dollars worth of work. In addition, we used to be able to ask for a matrix of hours of level of effort for certain categories of work. And in 2011, when the law changed, that tool was taken away from us. What we found is when we got the proposals, it really helped us hone in. Usually there were some outliers where someone had a very high level of effort and someone had an incredibly low level of effort, and we weren't going to hire them. It helped us hone in on what the true level of effort required was going to be. And we haven't been able to use that tool for quite a while, and we're glad to see that this bill with the amendment would give that back to us. So with that, I support it and don't want to take up any more of your time. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon, joining our colleagues, the engineers, with some concerns about Senate Bill 382. And I won't belabor the discussion that the engineers already went through because our concerns are about the same. I will say only two things. One is I've learned from personal experience that when I'm buying photocopy paper, I'm okay buying the cheapest when I go to the store. But I learned quite recently that you don't want to buy airline tickets that way because I ended up on Spirit Airlines. And if any of you have been on Spirit Airlines like I have, you understand that the least cost airline ticket is not always the best option for you to fly on. And so I encourage you to be careful about low-cost airlines. It seems to me that the League of Oregon Cities and Associated Oregon Counties, the engineers and the architects and the land surveyors are all committed to sitting down and seeing if we can find a way to make some common sense modifications to the QBS process. I guess I'm just hopeful that in the negotiations that we have a quality-based negotiation and not a lowest price cost negotiation in terms of who we bring to the table during these discussions. And so with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions and realize we'll have offline conversations. Thank you.
Senator Mayor and council members, I'm Bill Kirby, city attorney for the city of Beaverton. I've practiced law for 30 years, all at the city of Beaverton. I've been involved in the procurement process for 20 of those years. I echo the statement about level of effort is a good way of asking someone about how much time do you think it's going to take you to do this project. That's an impermissible question at the get-go for this type of QES process. If we just had a general question, how much would it cost you per hour to me talk to an architect? Just a telephone call, want to talk to you about something? What's that going to cost per hour? Can't ask that question. No one is suggesting that price be the deciding factor. No one is suggesting that it be the major factor. It is just simply, could we have some conversations about price? So I'm speaking here, obviously, in support of Senate Bill 382. And there needs to be some meaningful reform on QBS process. And I'll just leave you with one analogy that I think illustrates the problem we have with qualification-based selection, where you can't talk about price. And I'm just going to have you imagine that your child applies to college and is accepted at her first and second choice schools, both of which are excellent. Wouldn't you want to know the cost to attend both of those schools, those excellent schools, before you accepted her first choice? What if your child's first choice offers no scholarships, no financial aid? It's $50,000 a year. But the second choice school, also excellent, offers a scholarship and aid, so the actual cost is about $25,000 a year. Is that marginal difference worth the $25,000? Maybe yes, maybe no. But if you're using a QBS selection process, you have to reject the first choice school to find out what the second choice of school's offer is going to be. That is not right. There is some need for reform here. That's why we started the conversation. We'll continue the conversation. We'll be back, I'm sure. But that's the heart of the problem with QBS. Thank you for your time. I'll answer any questions you may
Thank
have.
Thank you. Questions?
I have one for Mr. Fuller. If this bill was to pass, there's nothing to prevent a city from still doing QBS, is there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rod, I'm not sure. I'd have to look at the bill again to see which part of it's permissive in terms of mandatory.
Any others? Seeing none, thank you very much, gentlemen. That's all I have signed up to testify on Senate Bill 382. Is there anybody else? Don't see any. So this one sounds like we've got some ongoing discussions, so we'll close the public hearing on that. And I want to we're sort of running a little long today. So Senate Bills 97 and 98, we're going to carry over to our next meeting, a future meeting. So we'll post those. So we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 454. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 454 directs the Department of Transportation to establish the Columbia Gorge National Scenic Area Highway Improvement Program. This measure comes to us. It does have a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means, so we do not have paperwork for it. We also have no amendment before us, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Vice Chair of the committee. My name's Chuck Thompson, Senate District 26, and with me today are some folks from my district. We have the seated in the middle is Tom Cramblett, Mayor of Cascade Locks, and we have Jess Grove on the far side, President or Chairman?
President of the Port Committee.
President of the Port of Cascade Locks, and we have Don Mann, the Port of Cascade Locks economic development person. And they're here today to tell you about Senate Bill 454.
Mr. Mann's in a different position than I'm used to seeing him.
That's because I swung it away.
Gentlemen.
I'll go ahead and start in.
Okay.
Senate committee members and Chair Byers. As the Senator said, my name is Jess Groves. I'm the Port Commission President. And we're here today to talk in support of Bill 454. The bill is a critical tool or instrument for us to move ahead economically in Cascade Locks. I moved into the area, and this guy sat next to me grew up there. His family comes from forever, but I moved there in 1962, and I was 12 years old, and there wasn't an I-84 running through Cascade Locks at that time, for you, those of you old enough to know that. But so Cascade Locks was a different community. And when they built I-84, like a lot of communities in the state where the freeways go through, you know, you get kind of cut off from things. And obviously over the years, traffic has increased and a lot of things have happened out in the gorge. But I just want to say that I'm also on the Region 1 Act board, so I do know the critical needs of transportation funding. I also want to bring up a point before we get started here that some of you may or may not know. Representative Greg Walden, when he got the Fast Lane Act bill passed here a couple of years ago, wrote language in that bill for the Gorge Scenic Area. Actually, all the scenic areas in the United States, but most of them are about the size of this Capitol area here. So you see what he had in mind. And he had in mind every time we go to D.C. and we talk to the congressmen, we bring up both the Bridge of the Gods and the bridge in Hood River and their needs to continue to operate as bridges. And what that means economically, we found out when our bridge got shut down a bit all the way to Yakima. Okay? So one of the projects we're looking to fund over 15 years, we handed you guys our 15-year plan. Your leisure, you can obviously look it over. You can see in the green, that's where we're looking for some federal help and aid. Also, being on the Region 1 Act, I know that we're not low-hanging fruit, and I understand that. So that's why we're here today talking to you fellas to try to get this thing through the system here and understand that if a transportation bill doesn't pass, probably nothing's going to happen. So, but we're here anyway. But anyway, we can't get a STIP right now because we're not there. It may be 100 years before we're considered for a STIP. But there is money based on the Fast Lane Act that we can put our hands on through ODOT and come our way. And we're going to be in D.C. on the 11th doing our lobbying thing, and we're going to talk about that there. But basically, when they built I-84, they built an exit into Cascade Lock so you could go across the Bridge of the Gods. And they built another overpass out on the east side, but they only did coming in from the west and going out to the east. So every time we now try to get a business out in our business park, what we run into is huge issues. And I heard the ODOT lady sitting up here saying how critical safety is to them, and it is to us. Our community members come up and say, we can't have trucks running through our community, through our housing district, where the kids play and things like that. So we need to work on getting some exits and stuff off of I-84. And we're putting skin in the game here. I'm not a lobbyist, and I'm not an attorney, but we know we need to put skin in the game. We're having these projects scoped right now, and we're looking at ways to put puts more skin in the game. As a matter of fact, I'm going to meet with the OTC chair, Tammy Bainey, here pretty soon to talk about how we can work together. But this, I want to, before I move on, I want to thank all of you for having us here today and listening to our story, and especially thank Senator Thompson for introducing this bill for my small, needy community. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom Gramlett, Mayor of Cascade Locks, and my family's been there since the late 1800s, so I've been there all of my life. And thank you, Chair, thank you, Committee, for listening to us today. So I would just echo some of Jess's concerns about the community as far as transportation goes. We've basically got one road through town, and we just celebrated the 100-year celebration of the Scenic Highway. Scenic Highway didn't last very long because of truck traffic. 1916 is when they opened it up. And by the 30s, they're already going to a river level route as a two-lane road, and it didn't take long for the truck traffic to overwhelm that. And by the late 50s and into the 60s, you've gone to a four-lane freeway. But Cascade Locks, my main street is Wanapaw, and then off of Wanapaw we have Forest Lane that goes out to our industrial area. Both of those streets are the Scenic Highway. So basically, the road through Cascade Locks was the road built in 1916, and that's what all trucking, all traffic has to go through Cascade Locks. When they built the freeway, again, as Jess said, we have it's a full exchange, but it's a full exchange on half exchange on one end of town, half exchange on the other end of town. So our industrial park, everything has to go down this basically down the Scenic Highway to get through town, through the downtown area and through the residential area. So it makes it really difficult for us. The biggest industry we had there was in the timber industry, which is the big mills that have gone away from us, but how they received their product and sent their product out was the logs came in by the river and the lumber went out by rail. So not a lot of truck traffic was happening there, but in today's world, everything moves by truck traffic. So in order for us to move our community ahead economically, it would be nice to be able to get an exchange. And again, I support them with the help that they need to have on the Bridge of the Gods, which is a important bridge across the river in that spot. But thank you.
Thank you, Mayor.
Chairman Beyer, Vice Chairman Thompson, thank you for the opportunity to be here today and allowing us to support Senate Bill 454. My name is Don Mann. I'm the Economic Development Manager for the Port of Cascade Locks. Worn a lot of hats over the years and tried to retire, but just said it's not time yet. Anyway, I would especially like to thank Senator Thompson for drafting and sponsoring this piece of legislation. And I'm going to try to do this in 2 minutes and so we can get out of here. The National Scenic Area will continue to grow economically as the National Scenic Area communities grow and prosper, and that's by bringing in new businesses and creating jobs. It's vitally important for this committee to support this proposed legislation and establish the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area Highway Improvement Program. Improving the I-84 highway system within the National Scenic Area is critical and needed to assure continued and positive economic growth within the National Scenic Area communities. And we're not just talking about Cascade Locks. There's communities all up and down the gorge in the National Scenic Area that need attention for transportation and safety. It is equally important that the Oregon Department of Transportation collaborate with the Washington State Department of Transportation to assure that all transportation routes and bridges within the national highway system benefit from this legislation. As you know, when the Columbia Gorge National Scenic Area Act was passed, it included both Oregon and Washington, and that's why it's important to collaborate with WASDOT as well. Transportation connectivity to assure safe and continued movement of goods and services within the NSA communities and planning successful multimodal transportation projects is imperative. Please develop and implement a comprehensive Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area transportation plan by addressing traffic mitigation, methods for improving traffic safety, the environment, protection issues, and growing businesses in the National Scenic Area. There are a couple items in the bill, and I spoke to Senator Thompson about this clarification, some friendly amendments we'd like to recommend, and it's on lines 9, 12, and 16. On line 9 is to include developing in partnership with WASDOT, which is not in there. On line 12, to add a westbound on-ramp at exit 47 that Jess and Tom both talked about. And then on line 16, construct adjustments to allow access to the frontage road from the existing way station in Cascade Locks. And that is also what we referred to. When President Groves talked about skin in the game, the port is budgeted $30,000 of port money, but public money, set aside to have specific projects scoped out. And those are the four projects. I submitted with staff a site map showing the four project areas, and so you can be familiar with it. And the also included with that handout is the port's 15-year maintenance plan for the Bridge of the Gods, which is a $58 million maintenance plan for the maintenance of that bridge over the next 15 years. So please take all these things into consideration. We'd like to continue to work with Senator Thompson on some of these clarifications, and we appreciate this time today. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. As noted, we've been talking a lot about transportation, and everything seems to start out at $50 million.
And that's just one bridge. Yeah.
Plus you're in Portland.
Questions of the panel? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen. And I believe this one needs some work yet. So we will close the public hearing, and we'll work on it another day.
Thank you.
Close. And gentlemen.